Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the April 18th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I just arbitrarily put accents in different words here. I'm Will Swain, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist. He's the host of the Capital Record podcast, the author of Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life, and of course, the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. How are you, sir?
I'm good. And I get to read something for National Review. Did you know, David, that I will be among National Review's more celebrated contributors? That is to say that they are all more celebrated than I. For two National Review events here in California, they are called Foundations of Freedom, The Importance of America's Constitutional Pillars. These are afternoon programs, one in Newport Beach on April 30, the other in San Jose on May 1st. They'll both run from about 2:30, 3 o'clock until sometime in the early evening with cocktails and conversation afterward. The speakers include Janice Rogers Brown, former California Supreme Court Justice, National Review's editor Rich Lowry, magazine editor Ramesh Panuru, UC Berkeley Law Professor John Yu, and yours truly. Registration details and precise locations are in the show notes. Hope to see you there. David, I hope to see you there. I'm kidding. Where are you going to be at the end of the month? You're going to be
That's the deal where I'm here actually on that Monday, and hopefully we can record that day, but then I have to fly to Florida for a big business event.
That was it. Yeah. Yes. David, there is so much to talk about. You and I were going to record yesterday, and thank goodness we didn't, because in the meantime, the universe was put back onto its axis in some small way, I think. I wanted to just, if you don't mind, I wanted to talk about this story that I didn't even put in the show notes, and now I can't find it. So I'll just do it from memory. Yesterday, 28 workers who work for Google were fired by Google for occupying offices, blocking employee access, defacing company property, all in the name of fighting for Hamas and an end to the Israeli incursion in Gaza. They say that the protesters say that Google is supporting apartheid. The company said, you beat it. 28 people, some of whom were arrested first and then 28 terminated. The workers say they have a right to do this.
I wish they had been terminated.
Oh, some of them were.
No, I mean terminated.
Oh.
what a bunch of dirtbags.
But aren't you pleased? Because
I'm so pleased. And we should be too. And I don't want to hear one person who is in the Radio Free California mindset, who's a National Review type, someone on the right, anti-woke, anti-ESG, anti-cancel culture. I don't want to hear one person say like, well, you know, too little, too late. Or this is just simply an unadulterated good that Google did. And it is a little surprising because we know that they have not always been on the right side of these issues. But it's Google doing it, which means it trickles down to other companies. Now, there's a permission structure to say, okay, if Google can shoot these hooligans in the face, we're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of these companies needs to take any one of their people that is acting this way and terminate them. And if they get sued for wrongful termination, go defend themselves in a court of law and win. Don't settle with these sons of bitches. Dead serious.
Yeah, no, it's really remarkable to watch the comments in stories in the mainstream media, especially when I say mainstream, I'm talking about places like the New York Times and LA Times, et cetera, where the argument against the firings is, well, what about the First Amendment? You don't have a First Amendment protection against a private employer. You have one against the government, perhaps, but the government's not involved here. This is Google's private property.
But you don't have a right with government property to go block the Brooklyn Bridge.
Fair point.
Or make flights late at JFK.
Or the Golden Gate Bridge, as happened in the last few days. Right.
That's right. And so whether it's California or New York, these shenanigans need to stop.
Is that not in there? We're trying to calibrate sound over here. I think we got it.
Well, at first it was too quiet, so I turned it up, and then it turned it up to a point where I have lost all hearing, and I know that's a touchy little knob.
It really is very sensitive. It's like that shower thing in the hotel where it's scalding, and yeah. Right. There is so much to get to.
Gaffigan's bit on a Hot Pocket in the microwave. You literally, and it's like you're either for eating ice or lava, and there is no in between.
So. New game for kids, the Hot Pocket game. You know what, David, let's jump ahead in the run list. We'll come back to some of these other items, but I want to point out that, you know, along with Google firing these employees and I think defending property rights and business and sanity in the workplace and protecting a lot of other workers who felt intimidated by these protesters, by the way, there's this kind of thing. We've charted this. We're not unique in saying this, but I just wanted to point out that we've had, I think, you know, at least three big stories this week in California where progressives themselves have been the targets of anti-Semitic attacks by people who say, we're just for a ceasefire, we're just for Palestinians, but who are really, in calling for a ceasefire, I would argue, this is just opinion, you call for a ceasefire with Hamas, what you're calling for is endangering Israelis again and again for generations, but that's just me. But anyway, what I want to talk about specifically was, let's start with UC Berkeley professor Erwin Chemerinsky, not just professor, dean of the Berkeley Law School, whose house was the scene of a dinner party, let's point out. So Chemerinsky and his wife, who's also a professor in the law school there at Berkeley, are hosting a dinner last week, I think it was Thursday night, for people who are graduating from the law school. Just their own house out in Oakland, not on the Berkeley campus. And then some of the students who are, again, pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas, stand up and start to denounce the university for its investments, quote-unquote, in Israeli companies and the support of an apartheid state. Chemerinsky, the dinner quickly devolves after that because one of the guests, a young woman, stands up and you can see her pleading on video, you know, like, I'm just going to say what I got to say. And Chemerinsky and his wife, Catherine Fisk, get up and ask the woman, please, this is just not the place. Can you please just put the microphone down? She will not. She resists. And Fisk tries to grab the microphone away from her. There's much tussling. At the end of it, the protesters are all booted from the Chemerinsky's home. And the woman goes immediately into the press and says, like, look, my First Amendment rights have been violated because he is the dean of the law school and I'm a student there. This is government action against my speech rights. He points out, the house is privately owned by my wife and me. The mortgage is in our names. It's on a street in Oakland. It is not owned by the university. It's not on university property or in any way paid for by the university. It is private property, and the First Amendment simply does not apply here. No one has the right to come into my house or yours and disrupt a dinner. As a matter of constitutional law, this is absolutely clear. We have the same or similar story going on just down the street here at USC, where the valedictorian, who was scheduled to speak at the university, we find out that, in fact, she had prepared her remarks as a clarion call for resistance to apartheid in Israel and free the Palestinian people. The provost of USC decides, you know what, that's enough. We're done with that. This is not the appropriate place. It will create chaos at a moment when the students are trying to just graduate and move on with their lives and celebrate. The provost writes in announcing that the valedictory speech will be canceled. He says the decision is not only necessary to maintain the safety of our campus and our students, but is consistent with the fundamental legal obligation that universities act to protect students and keep our campus community safe. Now, celebrate USC for, I think, making the right decision. But let's point out that buried deep in all the stories that
can I ask you a question before
please,
you get there?
Yeah.
Do you think that their stated reason is the right reason?
Campus safety?
Yeah. What would you think if they, because by all understanding, she did earn valedictorian meritocratic.
That's
right.
She had a 3.8 or 9, right? Yeah.
3.8 gets you valedictorian?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, you know, 3.98. I'm sorry. So it's almost 4.0. 3.980.
Oh, that's right, because it's high school where they have the stuff over 4.0.
Yes.
With all the BS stuff.
Right.
Where, like, the dumbest kid gets, like, a 3.7.
That's right.
We did not have that in my high school, in case you're wondering.
Yeah. Do I think the campus
what
safety?
What would you think, from a academic freedom, free speech, you know, blah, blah, blah standpoint, if USC had said, we think your viewpoint you're spreading is hate-filled and anti-Semitic and terroristic, and unpatriotic and morally ambiguous, and we don't want you to give the valedictorian speech.
That's what I think you're headed to the same place I am, which is calling for campus safety. Reminds me of the French Revolution, where the Committee of Safety, et cetera, and then you go out and guillotine people. No, this is not about just campus safety. It's about the university's right to shape the student experience, the campus experience, in the way that USC wants to. It is a private university. Even if it were a public one, I would say
although
they have a requirement
here. I think that
here.
There's rules about the valedictorian, right?
Sure. Yes, they have to meet the sort of, you know, this.
Yeah, but they made it, but they met it. So in other words, it would be a controversial move to pull someone.
Sure.
But in this case, you could, like, if some, okay, if there's a 4.0 kid who was a member of the Third Reich.
Right.
And was putting up swastikas.
Yes.
I would like to think they'd say, like, you know, congratulations on your GPA.
Yes.
We're still not super fond of your views on yeah. the this stuff. You know, I don't want to make a joke, but you know what I'm getting at. This awful, you know, thing. I guess what I'm saying is that they did the right thing, and yet we're still afraid to state the right reason.
Agree.
Campus safety.
And
what's that mean? Everyone's drunk.
Right. Yeah, and tailgating before the game. Right. So here's what's fascinating. The woman was elected valedictorian, as we said, because she had a GPA. I'm sorry. She didn't have a 3.980. She had a GPA, it says here, greater than 3.980.
3.981?
Well, here's what's fascinating to me. I don't know what, you know, the GPA, she's got a high GPA, let's stipulate. But her majors were in biomedical engineering, which, wow, awesome. And she has a minor, David, in resistance to genocide. And then USC acts somewhat surprised that a person who has a minor in something called resistance to genocide might decide that resistance includes hijacking a public ceremony at her own alma mater in order to preach hate. There are these internal contradictions inside the system, as you pointed out, that the declaration against this kind of speech could have been shaped on moral rather than public safety grounds.
Congratulations to the anti-Semitic pro-terrorist student at USC who studied hard for, you know, calculus.
That's right.
It's good.
Yeah. So then finally, we have a Long Beach congressman. This is, I'm so sorry. Here we go. Assembly member of the California State Assembly, Josh Lowenthal, who has submitted a bill, Assembly Bill 2351. And the whole point of the bill was to eliminate or to allow public schools in California to clamp down on off-campus activities of students who engage in bullying or even acts of assault against other students off campus. Here was what the sort of predicate, if you will, the event that had Josh Lowenthal of Long Beach thinking about a bill might be thinking that a bill might be necessary in the assembly. It was that his daughter received a swastika on her social media account from a fellow student. Mm. So Lowenthal went to the school and said, like, look, here's the evidence that this happened. You need to do something. And the school said, sorry, we can't handle off-campus acts of speech, bullying, or sexual or physical assault. So he said, boy, there ought to be a law. And Josh Lowenthal, who is Jewish, runs immediately into the progressive buzzsaw inside the state capitol, particularly his adversary in this is Mia Bonta. People recognize Mia Bonta from her performance as the replacement for Rob Bonta when he moved over to the Attorney General's office to take Javier Becerra's place. Rob Bonta is our Attorney General. His wife Mia is among the most progressive left-wing Democrats in the Assembly. And she says, you know, we can't do this. You need to handle this at home. I get that it's, you know, really difficult for you. But boy, this happened to me and I didn't ask the state to step in and protect me. So Mia Bonta is all about like, handle this on your own at home because you're a good parent when it suits her. But boy, if what parents want is to know about what's actually going on with their kids in terms of gender ideology or political indoctrination at the schools, that's a bridge too far. Then the state must step in. But send a kid a swastika, and, you know, we're okay with that. So
one could definitely get confused figuring out what the rules are. But I don't know. I think if you have means and you put someone from NPR on retainer to tell you what's allowed and not allowed, you'll be better off. Because it is hard to keep track of the rules. You know what's funny, just while you're shuffling through 400 papers to get to the next thing? I had to record some speeches this week for the I have shareholder proposals on the docket for a couple of publicly traded companies that we own, and I have resolutions that are going before the shareholders for vote, and I get to record a speech that is played at the annual shareholders meeting. And this, there was a point in two of the different speeches I gave where I had to say LGBTQ. And you only have 3 minutes for your speech with some, it's 2 minutes for others, and you have to go kind of quick. And I had written out my speech ahead of time, and then I'm going through, and I muffled the things, but I was like, not on purpose. I really didn't. But I was thinking about how that's like a byproduct of, you just don't know, because they've changed, they've added letters, they subtract letters.
The plus sign is in there now.
And then there's things that we were, as kids, really ingrained in us that you could say, and words you couldn't say.
Right.
And I do think it's fair to say that one of the big differences is that they used to change the rules really slowly.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's words that it would go from such and such a word to another word over 10 years or over a generation. Mm-hmm. That's allowed, whatever. But now it just changes so quickly. And then things like what can be said, what students have to be notified, a swastika's this, a gender operation's this, but then the things that they'll tell, like, we're sending you home because you said illegal alien.
Right.
But then the swastika thing is none of our business, or that part is a problem.
Yes.
But then the gender thing is not. You know, it just, you get to a point where it is satire.
It just is.
Well, it's laughable. I'm sorry.
It reminds me of the great line in Plato's Republic, and I'm not suggesting, like, oh, yes, I can recall the entire
opus. Oh, a white male.
Opus. Yes.
You think it's appropriate to follow up what I'm saying by quoting a dead white male?
I walked into a Del Taco once, and it said something like, love us for our Plato's. Well, it turned out to be the Spanish word for platos. Oh. Dinners. Yeah. Anyway.
So you thought it was a kind of anti-Socrates.
I thought that they were really into Plato. Yeah. I was very impressed that a fast food joint was into Greek philosophy, Western philosophy at all.
You know the difference between Plato and Socrates?
Tell me.
We know Plato existed. It's my new thing. I'm trying to start a new conspiracy theory. by the way, there's all four of you that got that joke right now. Congratulations.
on
being just as geek nerd out as me and Will are.
Thank I God. Am so far into footnotes of footnotes here. But my point was about Plato was just going to be that, what does he say? That writing law is like cutting off the heads of a hydra. And you absolutely see that with the identity politics thing, the just constant metastasization or spread of new identities as every individual wakes up each day and determines they've discovered something new about themselves and must broadcast it to the world. But my major point here, David, with all these stories about Hamas, pro-Hamas demonstrators showing up at universities, for instance, or in even high schools in California, is to suggest that this is and again, not unique in saying this, but this is a real wake-up call for progressives, I think, and some of them are answering it. Like Erwin Chemerinsky has begun to denounce anti-Semitism on his campus as he experiences it. Not something that he had previously ever been noteworthy for.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? That there are every now and then these issues that come up. The DEI cancel woke culture put people like Matt Taibbi, Andrew Sullivan, who was always a little bit of a mixed bag.
Yeah.
It's taken certain left-wing actors and forced them to get out of a comfort zone.
Bill Maher, Barry Weiss. Yeah.
And then anti-Semitism now. You know, I think Alan Dershowitz is one.
Mm-hmm.
But 9/11 did that to a lot on the left. Mm-hmm. Christopher Hitchens is a famous example. He didn't become a right-winger.
No.
And if anything, he was so morally incoherent.
Yes.
But it was, I think, just the shock of like, oh, Abe Greenwald is a dear conservative and one of the sweetest people I've ever met, who's John Podoritz's right-hand guy at Commentary. He said it was 9/11 that made him a conservative. Because he just woke up and he was like, yeah, this is like horrible. And then he saw the left responding to it the way they did. He goes, oh, I'm not one of you.
Right.
And that's the moment I would think a lot of people on the left are having about anti-Semitism. Irwin's not going to become one of us. But, I mean, him standing up against anti-Semitism is a good thing.
And understanding in such a clear way that there's such a thing as property rights is interesting to me. Because I think once you begin to seize on the argument as a defense against, you know, somebody occupying your home, that you have the ownership of this home, it's your name on the property, you've established, I think, one of the I think, major pillars, premises of Western theory, Western legal theory and philosophy. Before we move too far off, let me just get rid of this little nutpicking thing that I know probably offends you grievously, David, but there's a proposal in front of the CTA right now, the California Teachers Association, to ban the Pledge of Allegiance. It reads this way: according to the CTA mission, we are an organization that opposes fascism, also an organization, love this line, that actively teaches and trains that nationalism is a tentpole of fascism, and the practice of pledging the allegiance to a country or flag is base nationalism. We also have members who openly, it actually says that openly, gosh, these people teach and they can't write. I'm going to correct it, who openly oppose the idea of the pledge and demonstrate their opposition through the addition of such words as someday into the statement that promises freedom through a declaration of loyalty. So just want to say, these are the people, David. This has not been approved yet by the entire CTA. My guess is it dies strangled in its crib. But the fact is that there are teachers out there who think that this organization is theirs, that they have a right to speak for the organization and insist that these kinds of ideas are normal. And this the normalization of this idea, you're going to just immediately shred that. You're done with it.
No, I'm not. I understand you bringing it up. Here's what you don't do what I'm bothered by. What I'm bothered by is right now those on the right who would take the suggestion and the radicals doing it and go present CTA looking to blah, blah, blah. Hmm. Where I imagine they're 5 minutes away from doing it. And honest reporting, you're a former journalist, not me. But you would agree that you could, you know, when people go report Bill Smith allegedly mowed down his wife and kids, mm-hmm. police are looking at him as a person, you can destroy a person
yes.
beforehand, right?
Right?
We know this in criminality and, sure. and due process and reasonable doubt and things that are part of our justice system. Here's the thing, Will. I'm not worried about you. I'm worried about those on the right that take what is not picking often in extremism to go say like, oh, they're looking to shut us down again because one guy tweeted something about we need more lock. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I think it's the biggest story of our podcast if they pass it.
Mm-hmm.
And until they pass it, you know, let's watch it. But it's worthwhile noting with all the caveats that you gave that there's some radicals there that want to do it. We already know that. But you know what I'm saying? I think it reminds me of, I'm sorry to reminisce here, but I guess I can just do whatever I want.
It's kind
of the way I feel about a lot of things. In 1997, I had hosted a Christian conference at Cal State Fullerton, kind of a philosophy theology deal. And there was a group of us afterwards back at somebody's house. And this was a life-changing moment for me. I thought Bill Clinton was a bad president who may have done, in hindsight, some things I'm really fond of, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, really was obviously moral lowbrow and even on a policy standpoint was not continuing on what I thought was a Reaganite, you know, tradition I would have liked to see in our country. I was a young man. And so a group of us were sitting around. And he had appointed Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the court. He had vetoed a partial birth abortion ban. He'd done these crazy things. And a group of people said, there was a particular person, rather, in this group who said, you know, there's nothing that Hitler or Stalin did that Bill Clinton wouldn't do if it meant protecting his power. And then I was thinking about, you remember those Clinton Chronicles videos where he had like 22 people he had murdered?
Right, right.
And some of it was like, I think him and Hillary didn't hire a hitman. They did it themselves.
Yes.
In an alley behind an airport where they're like, hey, meet us there. We want to talk to you.
Yes.
And then they're like, yeah. shooting the guy down. So, okay. And I remember just thinking, hey, you know what else we know about Bill Clinton besides that he's murdering people in an airport and is the same as Hitler?
With a drumstick in one hand and a pistol in the other.
But what we know about him is that he just appointed Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the Supreme Court and vetoed a partial birth abortion ban.
Yeah, that's it.
Why do we always feel the need to go to the cray-cray when we have just what they're doing right out there? The CTA needs no exaggeration or embellishment of what these idiots represent. You're not doing that. I want to make that as clear as I can.
Oh, thanks.
But I think that there are so many on the right now that are not honest brokers who would take this story to portray it something differently. Now, well, you know what's going to happen? They're going to pass this and everyone's going to say, like, God, aren't you a genius?
No, because
when Bill Clinton's going to get, they're finally going to catch the DNA evidence.
Linking Clinton to 22
I'll take
murders.
It all back, you know.
Well, this is part of the problem, that you never want to be held hostage to fortune if you're a reporter, a good reporter. I'll just point out that, you know, yesterday I chastised a Sacramento Bee reporter for saying that a thing had happened, which in fact will be voted on tonight. And I'm speaking specifically about a school district here in Southern California, Murrieta, that the reporter at Sacramento Bee, Andrew Sheeler, said, oh, they're backing away from, they're going to abandon their parent notification bill. Well, that's not clear at all. There's a vote on it tonight. He did not mention there's a vote on it tonight. He just said they're going to do it. They're going to, it's already dropped. And then he failed to cite all kinds of reasons that they wouldn't do it. But you never want to be held, you know, hostage to fortune by predicting that a thing is going to happen. And I think that you're absolutely right in making sure that we understand this. My point is, compare and contrast Google's behavior with a bunch of people who do a terrible thing. And you could argue that this is, you know, at least nominally less vicious, this California Teachers Association proposal to ban the Pledge of Allegiance, except that these teachers say, avowedly, we're an anti-fascist organization. We teach this to our students to be anti-fascist and to be anti-nationalist, which is their way of talking about patriotism, pure and simple. So, and I'm just going to jump here, David, just to dismiss one of our stories because I know we're super short on time. But I do want to say that that the CTA is also the reason that a bill to improve literacy in the schools will probably be torpedoed. That's Assembly Bill 2222, which would help schools implement evidence-based reading instruction. It's something that California Policy Center supports. But the teachers union says, no, you can't improve literacy, because if you do it, it's a one-size-fits-all approach that will be problematic because...
Did they write that out with words? Or was that kind of a...
They did indeed. Thank you for pointing this out. And they counted on us to be able to read it. They complain that any improvement in reading will probably be culturally biased against students of color and the local community. So if you improve literacy, you are necessarily going to damage marginalized students. It says here, they also complain the method would not serve the ESL learners and might not, quote, reflect the values, priorities, and cultural context of the local community. My colleague Lance Christensen spoke to... I think it's called The Lion from the Herzog Foundation. He tells them, that's garbage. If you have a literacy program that is scientifically based and effective, you'll be more successful with your English learning language learning students. The one-size-fits-all argument is garbage, because if you have teachers who are trained about how to teach literacy, then they're actually going to teach each kid differently anyway, and not just throw a book at them and hope they can figure it out. All right. So let's get back to the actual order of these stories, David. I just want to get your feedback on something. It really feels like O.J. died this past week, O.J. Simpson. The headlines were immediate and funny and mocking, including among my favorites, cancer murders O.J. And finally, O.J. can rest knowing that his wife's killer is dead. I think it's a Norm Macdonald line.
Well, it couldn't have been a Norm Macdonald line.
No, it was, I think, it's a Norm Macdonald-ish. It's just people,
yeah.
Sorry. It's, yeah, you get it. Because Norm was famously so OJ-centric.
Funny. You got him fired at NBC.
Yeah. But
imagine that we lived in a time where NBC was trying to be politically correct about protecting OJ. And in fairness, it wasn't political correct. It was a friendship with the then president. I believe it was Brandon Tarkenoff with OJ. And then he fired Norm Macdonald for telling OJ jokes all
right,
the time.
Right, on SNL. Yeah. But my point is two things. Number one, I'm always really, I don't know, tentative or averse, despite the fact that I just read these, you know, sort of funny
to
amusing
body being
headlines.
Warm and
yeah, you know. There's that, because also this may sound goofy, but you know, I don't know precisely what happens on the other side of death. I have a theological sense of what it looks like, a faith in a shaped sense of what happens next, and it's got to be terrifying. And my first instinct is actually to pray for the souls of the recently departed rather than to mock them. But I do think it's important here, second, to talk about this, because already his death was noteworthy the day it happened, and then it was like Osama bin Laden being chucked out of a helicopter in the ocean, right? It was like he is gone.
You know, you're really inside my text with my son on this one, because he sent a joke right after OJ died, and he goes, "Dad, how come you're not tweeting about it or doing this or doing that?" And I go, "You know, when someone dies, I usually just don't like to go after it." And then he came back and goes, "You retweeted Norm MacDonald the day Charles Manson died."
Uh-huh.
And I was like, "Okay, thanks for, you know, auditing my..."
Jeez.
But, you know, it was Charles Manson. And so here's the category that I think you're talking about, that I'm talking about, that I actually feel real strongly about it. Like someone like John McCain, I couldn't stand all my conservative friends that would post like, "You know, I disagreed with him on a lot of things, man. And I do not think this guy was a good conservative, but, you know, condolences to the family." And it was like, okay, we don't need your political qualifier the day he died.
Right.
Like, oh my God, you feel bad that for his family died and you used to have political disagreements with this guy?
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm.
I would have never guessed that anyone would have political disagreements with anyone.
Yeah, sure.
It's a way of like a look at me kind of virtue signaling BS. I can't stand it.
Did I just do it?
No, but what I'm saying is OJ is like, there's two people he killed. Charles Manson, there was, what, 13, 17?
I don't even remember. Something. I lost count.
And then Osama bin Laden. Like, I don't think it was a time for jokes, but it was sort of a time for celebration. Like, there's a moral line.
Yes.
And so whenever, I feel I've had people that died that I didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
That they weren't killers.
Mm-hmm.
They were just people I did not like.
Right.
And not because like, oh, John McCain once voted for a tax. You know, there was just like, I didn't like, they're bad people in ways, right? I just they're gone. I don't need to say nothing. And I'm not virtue signaling it. I'm trying to make clear that, like, I think there's a propriety to letting the dead be dead. And if you're not, like, it's 4 months later, you want to go after someone, 4 months, you know, but let the body get buried and all that kind of stuff. But obviously you and I don't think that about Osama bin Laden and Hitler.
No.
And so then with OJ, it's like, well, you got to kill 20 people to get that.
Mm.
Like, what's the number, right? So I kind of think the problem with the OJ deal is not us, and it's not trying to figure out how many people you kill before we're nice to you when you die. God, will you quit drinking coffee when I'm talking, for Pete's sake? I don't think it's a body count. I really do think that the OJ was already a caricature.
Yeah.
Before he died, it was Norm MacDonald 30 years ago. Yeah. It was the Twitter. It was memes. It was this guy was a laughing stock of the justice system, the failure of the justice system. It's been characterized so much in pop culture. So I kind of just think he, like, there's a mulligan on this guy.
Yeah.
Because I laughed at some of the stuff, but then I said, like, I wouldn't post anything. I was laughing at others. So what does that say about me?
Let me ask you this. I think what it says to you is that there is something else here, and I think you are starting to get at it. There's also just that this was a guy who started off life in a difficult situation. You know, he was not born to a wealthy family, but he had a mom and a dad, and they took care of him, and... he grew up, he was born and raised in San Francisco, went to San Francisco Community College, I think, ended up at...
He was in a suburb of Oakland for high school, went to San Francisco for a bit before coming to USC.
Yeah.
Poor neighborhood.
Yeah.
But mom and dad, and then a football star.
Right.
So let's put it this way. He grew up in much worse circumstances than I did, and much better circumstances than a lot of other people did who didn't cut their wife's head off with a knife.
Yes. And that's, you know, I was going to, I actually just copied, I think the best story on this that I read, and I read, I don't know, 6 or 8 stories about, you know, obits, let's say. But Jim Garrity, who's at National Review, is just phenomenal. And I think it's because he really gets at, well, here's his point. He says, Simpson turned into one of the most terribly influential Americans of the last quarter of the 20th century, terrible both in the scale of his influence and in the moral dimension of his influence. And specifically, Jim goes on to point out that this was a guy who had become very wealthy, very close to powerful people. Most of those people, white people. Yes, he had black friends, but he had a lot of white friends. And as soon as he is accused of his wife's murder and the murder of Ronald Goldman in 1994, the wheels of justice begin to turn against for him and against the police investigators. And it's where his attorneys actually succeed in portraying him as a victim of white justice, a white mob. Even though OJ was very close to the police, to the LAPD in particular. So it's just, it was an interesting read, in part because, you know, what we get is one of those moments. This comes 2 years after the Rodney King riots, right? 1994. By 1995, everybody, you know, you're either convinced he was innocent because the police are racist and he's a black man, which was the OJ's defense.
That was the defense. It was not really the position of the black community. The position of the, what you're referring to at the time was not that they're convinced he's innocent, but that we're celebrating him being acquitted even if he isn't innocent.
That's right.
That's very different.
I think the attempt on the part of the defense, though, was to say, look, this is a victim of white violence. And that became the narrative of, I think, progressive lefts and the black community. The surveys show that whites and blacks do this very differently.
There were blacks, maybe it was a few years later, but there was a movement of people that came that were really, and this was kind of, again, now you're talking about 2 decades later, that people that were coming back around the ESPN five-part documentary and then the FX dramatization really made the point, like, of all the people to say, I'm the a black man who's a victim of the white-on-black racism. This was a guy who, for all practical purposes, had almost no black friends.
That's right.
Who was in an entirely... I don't do the Uncle Tom language stuff these people do about a Clarence Thomas and whatnot. But what I mean is, this was a man who had very consciously, and I would argue, you've achieved a wealth and a prestige. You sold out your people by getting out of the ghetto. I think that's just ridiculous and offensive.
That's everybody's goal.
But what I'm getting at is, this was a guy who was really, really integrated in white America.
Yes.
In upper crest white America, media, culture, wealth, Brentwood, married a very attractive white woman, all these things. Look, that defense legally was a legal defense. It was what defense attorneys do, because they're just utter dirtbags and pieces of garbage. And they did what pieces of garbage do. They defended a murderer with lies. And yet, I think what we're talking about here in the 90s, this was such a huge moment in California and for the country. They were basically saying, two wrongs make a right. Because those cops did beat Rodney King illegally. And those cops should be behind bars. And then in the moment of the racial tension, there was a high profile opportunity to try to, like, even the score. And then they did it.
Right.
And I think, I don't know anyone who thinks it's right, but at the time that was the language. To me, it was just like, isn't there some real victimized black guy that could be your sacrificial lamb out there for this instead of this guy who had beaten her before and what, you know, all this
terrible stuff. Well, I think that's right. And one of the things that I like that Jim does so well in his piece is bring it all the way back to Robert Kardashian, who's on the defense team. And, you know, so part of the, what would you say, part of the legacy of the O.J. Simpson life biography is, we get fame for fame's sake. We get the Kardashians, who would, I think, would be nobodies if it weren't for their famous and wealthy father who dies.
That's so interesting you say that, because I actually don't think that's true at all.
Tell me.
But I'd have to talk to two of the women in my house that would know better than I would. I think her marrying Bruce Jenner and then a whole chain of events, like, I don't think that people know who Robert Kardashian is.
My point. My point is that they are lifted up to a kind of celebrity first by their father's wealth and his prominence. They're surrounded. The kids are early in their lives. They're surrounded by very wealthy and, you know, very prominent people in Hollywood. Immediately.
I'm not disagreeing. The look on my face is more because I never thought of it that way. They had, like, regular... They had wealth, but not wealth. They had, like, wealth. Like, Robert, like, was an attorney who made money. In Calabasas and in L.A., along with 1,000 other people or 10,000 other people. But, like, they weren't, like, you know what I mean? I don't know. What was the springboard? I think that, I don't even know why I'm doing this live, because I got to think through it. It's never occurred to me that Robert Kardashian's wealth was a factor other than anecdotally in what would become of the Kris Jenner matriarchal orchestration of their daughter's exploitation into wealth and weirdness.
I'm impressed that you know so much about this. Seriously. I know you don't watch it.
I have a daughter and a wife.
Right.
Watch it.
No.
I don't know one of the kids' names, but Kim.
No, it impresses me.
Oh, Chloe. I know Chloe. Was she the one married to Lamar Odom?
I can never remember. I'm so sorry. I ought to know this better, but I don't. But, you know, I think that the point here is that you have, and maybe Jim's not saying one thing caused another, that the OJ trial.
What was his Robert Kardashian point?
Just that, you know, I think he's just sort of bringing it together in an almost literary kind of way. Like, isn't it interesting? Robert Kardashian serves an OJ, and what is Robert Kardashian's family now famous for? They're famous for famous. They're famous because they are celebrities. Yeah. And I'm not going to take anything away from, what's the mother's name? Chris's business instinct, which appears to be amazing and highly sophisticated in marketing her children. Don't watch the show. Don't know much about it. Lots of makeup, I think. We've got such limited time. I do not want to skip these two last stories, David. I'm going to whittle this down. You wanted to talk last week about this headline. California is giving up to $150,000 to help first-time home buyers. This won't cause inflation. Applications for California's down payment assistance program for first-time home buyers is open. This from KTLA. The state-funded program called Dream for All is not a dream for all. It's a dream for some. We'll be giving out $250 million California dollars to assist thousands of first-time home buyers this year. Buyers can receive up to $150,000 toward their home purchase, but borrowers, including the co-borrowers, must be first-time home buyers, defined as someone who has not owned property or lived in a home owned by a spouse, blah, blah, blah. Must be a first-generation home buyer, meaning their parents don't own a home in the U.S. A home in the U.S., I think, is interesting. All applicants must be California residents. Boy, that's a conservative notion. You don't see that often. There's an income test for it, and you have to have a higher credit score. But part of the deal is that there's really no risk, David. If your home goes underwater and you can't make the payments, you do owe the down payment, the $150,000 back, but you don't owe anything else back. On the other hand, if you make some cash on it, you have to give the state some fraction of a percentage of the increase in value of your home. David, talk to me about the California Dream for All program.
A really awful, awful piece of economics. Look forward to what our friend Tony Lima would have to say about this. Just want to point out a very obvious factor. Do we have high home prices that then are producing ideas to help people like this? Is it because we have excessively high home prices? The answer is yes. Do we have high home prices because of low demand?
No.
We have high demand.
That's correct.
Does this add to demand or take away demand?
This adds to demand.
Oh, when you give people $150,000, it adds to demand?
It adds to the demand.
Can I write that down real quick?
You can.
So when you give people money to buy things, it's called a subsidy.
That's right.
The subsidy stimulate demand or cool demand?
Stimulates.
The stimulated demand lower prices or raise prices?
Raises them.
If we have a supply problem, does stimulated demand increase supply?
No.
That doesn't necessarily decrease supply either, but
correct.
Does it increase supply?
It does not.
So we have a problem we're not treating. We have a problem of low supply, and we're not treating it, and we're going to treat it with something that is going to make it worse by stimulating demand.
It is like Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act, which in fact poured trillions of dollars into the economy early in the Biden administration.
That was the Inflation Reduction Act. That was 2 years later.
Tell me about the Inflation Reduction Act.
The Inflation Reduction Act was a green energy deal that put like $300 billion in green energy stuff that was passed after his second term.
Fair enough.
I mean, after the midterm.
Yeah. But my point is that you keep pouring hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars into an economy in which supply is restricted by supply side problems in the economy coming out of the pandemic, and you're going to have inflation. Okay, fair enough. I'm going to skip this, go to this. Last story, David. You have 1 minute to talk about Javier Becerra, or shall I just do it on my own and
I'll let you go?
All right, so here it is. Javier Becerra, who used to be a congressman from California, then became the attorney general when, what's her bucket? Kamala Harris goes into the Biden. She decides to run for president. Jerry Brown brings Javier Becerra home to be the AG. He survives under Newsom. He files more than, I believe it's 140 lawsuits against Trump, Javier Becerra does, as California's AG. Almost all of them are entirely frivolous, but, you know, over 100 lawsuits against the Trump administration. I mean, it was Alvin Bragg on steroids here. But the bottom line is that Becerra now, there's a whisper campaign that says Becerra is coming back to California to run for governor, because in the meantime now, he has left the AG's office, of course, and then went into the Biden administration to run Health and Human Services, where I just want to point out that the headlines around his performance were terrible. It starts almost immediately. The very low public profile of Biden's health secretary, New York Times. Affirmative inaction. Why Joe Biden still hasn't fired his health secretary. White House frustrated with HHS Chief Becerra over handling of COVID. So as soon as he got to D.C., Becerra was hated. There was a whispering campaign. Susan Rice called him an idiot and used the B word, biatch, to describe his behavior. He has been terrible as HHS secretary and now says he's going to come back to California and run for governor, proving that feces floats, I guess. He'll be running against already announced candidates, our Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kounoulakis, former state president, Senate president pro tem, Tony Atkins, woof, state controller Betty Yee, nice person, terrible controller, and Attorney General Rob Bonta, who... enough said. So, David, any thoughts about our gubernatorial race, or we'll cover this in coming weeks? What do you say?
Yeah, we'll cover in coming weeks. I don't have any immediate thoughts other than the ongoing, obvious, just kind of sadness about the quality of people that we elect to serve in this state. It's gotten worse. It's kind of weird for me to say, because we're talking about OJ, and I just, the 90s, I had a lot more hope for California than I do now, and I know I'm not supposed to say that, but I do feel that things have gotten a lot worse in the 90s.
Why are you not supposed to say that?
Well, I think that I'm an optimist, and I don't want to discourage the troops, because we're out doing a lot of things to make the world better.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just generally don't really find it all that cathartic to sit around bitching about how bad things are, where most people these days on the right seem to make a living out of bitching about how bad things are.
Well, then
it's not my MO, but what I was getting at is the 90s in California, there was a sense in which the OJ trial was this big thing, the Menendezes we've talked about. But you know, at that time, Pete Wilson was governor.
That's right.
I did not feel like the state was lost as a recent high school graduate in my now starting off adult life and into my mid 90s, a guy in my mid 20s. You know, that like I just didn't feel that the state was lost, and I kind of sometimes do now. But here's the thing: Barbara Boxer got elected in 1992 by barely beating Bruce Oeschinson, who was one of the most pure conservative people who have ever run for office. And we had Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer for gazillions of years. And I'm sorry, even Gray Davis beating, becoming elected at the end of the decade. None of these people were as bad as the Newsom, Becerra, Kamala, who's the other, Padilla. There's just all these idiots. These just lowbrow, sub-intellect. They're just awful.
Yeah.
And like Boxer and Feinstein, I thought they were so bad at the time.
And they actually look like statesmen.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm totally serious.
Yes. I agree. No, I understand that. But look, I'll take a pledge right here, David. And that pledge is that I will begin looking for reasons for hope in the news. Like I am thrown to look for the negative, both by character and by profession. But there is good news out there, and I'll I had a couple of stories here that I cut, but I will I'll bring those to the fore. So, David, what we've got next here is an interview I recorded with my colleague at California Policy Center, Edward Ring. And if you have wondered at all about the state of energy, of water infrastructure in California, if you're wondering, like, can we really make an all-electric economy in the future? Ed Ring has the answers, and he's here next. Sarah, please roll that tape. All right, with me now is my colleague, my friend Edward Ring. We call you Ed Ring, then you and I have discussed why we never ever do that, of course. But Edward, you have been writing voluminously recently about energy and water, and I thought this would be a really awesome time for us to catch up. I think, you know, you and I have talked about this offline before. My own sense is every time I hear Gavin Newsom talk about quote unquote clean energy, I want to vomit. There is no such thing as clean energy. I always want to ask people, like, what's the over and under before the left, the environmental fanatics, begin to realize that they've been sold a bill of goods, that actually mining things like cobalt and lithium is maybe not gentle on the planet, and that certainly not shipping it from places like China, where they actually use prison labor and they don't have any environmental regulations at all, that this is a hazard, that the hazard of, the cost of shipping it, the fuel, the carbon emissions. Ed, let's just start with what kind of clean energy projects, quote unquote, you've been looking at. And, you know, my favorite among these that you've discussed before is floating offshore wind. Is it okay to start there?
Yes, absolutely.
So talk to us, Ed, about you've looked at this, describe what the project is and how will this help move us to a carbon neutral kind of utopia?
Absolutely, Will. But first, I have to respond to your initial comment. If you Google Edward Ring, you will find me. If you Google Ed Ring, you will not find me, but you may have a good laugh. And I think we should leave it at that. But let's talk about floating offshore wind. What you have to understand about floating offshore wind is, in here in the state of California, we have a very deep continental shelf that's right offshore. And that means that we can't, you know, drive pylons into the shallow ocean floor like they've done on the East Coast and like they've done in the North Sea, which is enough of a catastrophe environmentally. But at least from an engineering standpoint, it's a little bit more feasible. But what you have off the shore of California is water 4,000 feet deep. And so you have to have offshore floating wind turbines. And the floating wind turbines to date have barely been prototyped. There are some, I think they're off the coast of Ireland. They're in the North Sea somewhere. There's a 50 megawatt capacity field. That's the biggest one in existence. These guys here in California are proposing to put 25 gigawatts of offshore wind capacity. So, just gigawatt is 1,000 megawatts. So they've got a 50 megawatt installation. This is a 25 gigawatt installation, which means it's 500 times bigger than what they're talking about building, what they've already built, I should say. So how does that work? And you can go to the MIT Technology Review. You know, you don't have to go to some right-wing screed to find out what the engineering is and how infeasible it may be. There's engineering challenges that are being acknowledged by professors of engineering and writers for the MIT Technology Review, and I would recommend that article. And what you'll find is the biggest proposed floating wind turbine you can get right now, and again, it hasn't even been prototyped, is 10 megawatts. Okay, so to get 25 gigawatts, you'd have to have 2,500 of these things out there. You'd have to build that many of them. Yeah. And so what you're talking about is something that's 1,000 feet tall from the waterline to the tip of the rotor, when the rotor's in vertical position, 1,000 feet tall. Now, for perspective, the Statue of Liberty is about one-third that tall from the waterline to the tip of the torch. The Eiffel Tower is about 1,000 feet tall. So imagine 2,500 Eiffel Towers floating in the ocean. Another point of reference would be the Gerald Ford supercarrier, which is about 1,100 feet long. So you'd have, 2,500 Gerald Ford supercarriers tilted on their edge and pointing up into the sky. But you'd also have pontoons underneath and counterweights and tethering cables. And these tethering cables have to go 4,000 feet down and get anchored in the ocean floor. So just imagine you're going to have probably three of them for each of these floating wind turbines, which means you're going to have 7,500 of these tethering cables. And then you're also going to have 2,500 high voltage lines because you've got to get the electricity back to shore. And so you're going to have this dangling high voltage line putting out waves into the water. And then it's going to have to traverse 20 miles of seafloor before it gets to the shore, because they're proposing to put these 20 miles offshore. One, because that's where more wind blows, and two, because they're trying to sell this to people who live on the coast who don't want to be able to see these things. You'll, by the way, on a clear day, you'll still see something that big. So this is what you're talking about from an engineering perspective. And you've got to ask yourself, is this the most practical way to generate energy? You know, from almost every perspective you can imagine. I mean, environmentally, this has got to be a catastrophe. You've got turbulence on the waves, which affects marine life. You've got vibrations going underwater, which affects marine life. You've got electric waves from the high voltage lines, which affects marine life. You've got all of these anchors in the seafloor, something like, you know, nearly 10,000 of them, if you include the impact of the high voltage line along with the tethering cables. They're talking about possibly burying these high voltage lines in the seafloor instead of leaving them on the surface to mitigate that. So you've got all the disruption of doing that. And can you imagine how much you would have to industrialize the coast of California to build the ports and to build the submarines, the submersibles, the ships, the transportation conduits, the power line corridors, you would the battery farms. You'd have to do all kinds of stuff onshore in order to build these offshore floating wind turbines. So this is a tremendous waste when you look at it by comparison to anything else.
But I can imagine, confronted with these kinds of numbers, Gavin Newsom zeroing in on one thing and one thing only: jobs, good paying union jobs. Of course, that would pit him against environmentalists, which are a significant part of his coalition. But, you know, what you're describing is a massive infrastructure project of the sort that both Joe Biden and Gavin Newsom have promoted all along. That, you know, rejiggering the economy so that it's all oriented around these kinds of projects, this is a good thing, not a bad thing.
You know, massive engineering projects can be a good thing. And the problem we've got in California is you have the renewables lobby, you have the construction trade unions, and then you have, I guess you have the environmentalist community. And the environmentalist community will go to war with anybody who won't do renewables. And of course, the renewables lobby finds that very convenient for them. So they're going to, they now, you know, it's two against one. So the construction unions are thinking to themselves, you know, we want these good jobs, we want these big projects, but why should we fight against these other special interests when we can get those good jobs if we just go along? And I think that at some point, and I'm really hopeful, at some point these unions and their leadership, the members and the leaders, are going to recognize that we're destroying the world in order to save it, and we need to stop doing that. And we need to start doing projects that are big engineering projects that give them all of these great jobs that are also going to have a benefit for everybody else in the economy. Because that is in their interests, too. They've got all kinds of friends and family and relatives who aren't members of their union, who need to live in a state that has a healthy economy. And the way to do that is to invest, you know, state funds and subsidies. If you're going to do that, and if you're going to have these big projects, use that money for projects that make economic sense, that yield long-term economic benefits, that lower the cost of living, that make energy and water affordable and abundant instead of scarce and expensive. And again, these things are environmental catastrophes. So maybe members of the environmentalist community are going to start standing up and recognizing that we have trade-offs here that are not rational. We shouldn't be building these floating offshore wind turbines. There's better ways to accomplish our goals.
Well, of course, one of the other counter arguments one might deploy against somebody like Gavin Newsom or Joe Biden, saying, of course, we are going to do these great infrastructure projects and produce new jobs and we'll have this great project at the end. Maybe the counter example is the bullet train. Recent news came out, new estimates. Now we're at what's the total projected cost right now by the government? It's $130 billion.
It's $130 billion. And I'm glad that we get to talk about the high-speed rail, but just to finish on the offshore wind for comparison, that's going to cost, according to very conservative estimates, optimistic estimates, I should say, $150 billion. And you know what? Anybody who thinks it's going to come in at $150 billion or under this construction cost, I will bet and give you odds that it's going to be more than $150 billion. It'll probably be closer to $300 billion. And it's only going to produce, 10 gigawatts because you only get 40% yield from these wind turbines. So you got 25 gigawatts of capacity, and they always throw that number out there, and they don't tell you, wait a minute, wind doesn't blow all the time. So to get baseload power of 10 gigawatts, you're going to have all these battery farms. You're going to have to store it up when the wind's blowing a lot, and then you're going to have to release it when there's no wind. So that's about 10% of the amount of electricity Californians are going to need if we electrify our economy.
Let me just go over that. You're going to build 2,500 wind turbines anchored 20 miles offshore in water that is 4,000 feet deep.
Correct.
Each of these wind turbines is 1,000 feet tall, roughly the size, you said, of the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, or the Gerald Ford.
Tipped on its stern, right?
Correct.
And all of these things combined will generate how much electricity that we currently need? How much of our current requirement?
Well, in terms of baseload power, it would be the equivalent of 10 gigawatts of output. And California currently draws on average about 32, 33 gigawatts on average. And if we're going to electrify our economy, we're going to need to about triple that. So in other words, this grand project of electrification using clean energy that the state of California is talking about, the wind component, the offshore wind component of that will be good for about 10%. And that's probably best case. And by the way, they may not be able to build them at 10 megawatts each. The current plans are 5 megawatts each, and they'll need 5,000 of these things out there. It's crazy.
Can you imagine, I know I mentioned the high-speed rail, but can you imagine with me for a second, what does this, I live in Southern California where I can see on most clear days, I can see Catalina, which is 26 miles away.
That's right.
What is this, a wind farm, if you will, of this scale out on the ocean going to, I hate to sound like a guy who's deeply into aesthetics, but I am. What's that going to look like for folks who, and maybe you can tell us, where is this supposed to be located off the California coast? Do we know yet? Have they said?
Yes. Yeah, the leases that they sold so far are off the coast of Morro Bay, the San Luis Obispo County Central Coast, and they're also off of the coast of Humboldt County, way up north. And, the people that live there are really, really concerned about that.
Well, I wonder if not only are they concerned about the aesthetics, but also what does this do to maritime navigation? It sounds like this would be a vast, never mind ugly, but a vast area that would be really fraught with danger. I'm thinking back to the, you might remember this, Ed, a few years ago, there was an oil spill, which Gavin Newsom immediately pinned on Big Oil because a tanker anchored off the LA harbor had dragged its anchor across a pipeline. Turned out that it was state officials and port authorities who directed the ship to anchor where it did, which was in a network of undersea pipelines. And so I can imagine this place you're describing being even more puzzling, multidimensional chess in terms of trying to navigate through it or around it. I guess it's just an area that would be off limits to all shipping. Is that right?
I certainly wouldn't want to see big container ships trying to traverse these fields. It's about 500 square miles combined right now. And you're talking about aviation and shipping that could be quite a challenge. And again, what's going to happen to marine life? What's going to happen to aquatic life and birds and ships and planes. I don't think they've thought all of this through. I really don't think they've thought it through. You're talking about people living in Morro Bay, for example, who can't get a permit from the Coastal Commission to build a tiny seawall to protect their home. They can't get a permit to add a room to their house. They have to go through this incredible gauntlet. And most of the time, you know, they don't have the patience. They can't build anything. And all of a sudden, we're looking at this massive industrialization of the same coastline. I mean, the hypocrisy involved here is stunning. Where's the Coastal Commission?
That I think you've just found the lead to your Wall Street Journal piece. It's that. I mean, seriously, let's find you and I. Let's find that person who's trying to build with Coastal Commission support or permits a granny flat in the back backyard. And here we have 500 square miles of Eiffel Tower-sized wind towers, wind
turbines. An entire infrastructure onshore to support.
Onshore,
that.
Yeah. Okay, so let us do get back to the high-speed rail. Much in the news these days again because there's been new requests for more money. Always with the more money. I do wish this were video recorded because what you all just missed was Ed loving a kitty cat that decided it wanted down. And so Ed chucked it over on, I imagine, a bed or something. So, Ed, let's talk about the high-speed rail. What's going on there financially? How is this thing ever likely to be completed? I don't see it really ever happening. It's now like a war of attrition to get this thing built.
Yeah. Cats are always good for about a 10 to 50% bump in views for some reason. But high-speed rail, no, I don't know how it's ever going to get built. We're looking at $130 billion right now for a scaled-down system that's going to run from San Francisco to downtown Los Angeles. I can't remember if it includes an extension to Anaheim, but it definitely does not at this point include an extension south to San Diego or an extension north to Sacramento, which was the original project that had been sold to voters and estimated to cost $30 billion. Mm. And now it's $130 billion. And you want to also take into account that they're not intending any longer to have high-speed rail going through any of the San Francisco Bay region. So that's going to be at regular commuter train speeds. It's going to be integrated into the existing commuter train network. And the same is going to hold true in the urban area in Southern California. So you're looking at high-speed rail that's going to go basically from Gilroy to probably through the Tehachapis into the San Fernando Valley, and then it's going to turn into existing rail that they're going to link to the system. You know, so the 2.5 hours, why would I take 2.5 hours, by the way, to go from San Francisco to LA when I can fly there in an hour? You know, you're still going to have check-in. You're still going to have to drive to the train station instead of the airport. None of that. That's all going to be equalized. So it's really travel time, 2.5 hours versus 1 hour. But these trains aren't going to even do that anymore because the entire northern and southern urban sections of the line are going to be at normal speed. You know, this is a rail line. And here's another thing you have to take into account. That $130 billion, they're never going to be able to achieve that because they're spending $200 million per mile on the flattest, most forgiving topography in the world, which is the San Joaquin Valley. How are they going to punch through the Tehachapi Mountains for that kind of price? How are they going to be able to get through Pacheco Pass up north, which, you know, is where from Gilroy over to Los Banos, which is where the train has to go through those mountains? How are they going to build those tunnels at $200 million a mile? It's going to be tremendously more expensive than that. They're going to encounter all kinds of things that they don't foresee at this point. So $130 billion is very optimistic.
Well, so the $130 billion cost, I want to point out a couple of things. Number one, from a story in Reason by my friend and former colleague Eric Baim about this, he says, explaining the disparity, Ed, between the $33 billion or $30 billion original cost estimate and the now $130 billion estimate, the director of the high-speed rail system for California says he admits the estimate was unmoored from reality in the beginning. It was an estimate. Yeah. He says, Eric writes, it was an estimate made, quote, before any work was done. None of the environmental work was done. None of the design work was done. It was an estimate based on paper. Eric adds, but isn't that the point of making estimates? What good is an estimate done after the work is complete? So these are people who throw around words like estimates and unmoored from reality to describe their predecessor's work, but don't really have any intention of mooring their own arguments to reality. And I want to remind people that the reason we're talking about this high-speed rail at all is that it's supposed to be one more climate change initiative. It's supposed to help reduce carbon emissions. Talk us through that. What's the logic of high-speed rail at 133 billion or, you know, more by the time it's finished? What's the logic there?
Well, there's no logic, and I'm glad you asked that, because I want to point out an example of something that was just ridiculously expensive but very useful, and that would be the so-called Big Dig that connected downtown Boston to Logan Airport across the bay. You know, that made a trip from downtown Boston to the airport take 15 minutes instead of an hour and a half. And it took too long, and it was way over budget. But you know what? Everybody's glad they built it. Whereas if you look at high-speed rail, you know, to reduce climate change, the big deal is to lower vehicle miles traveled, VMT. You know, they're making it more expensive to build subdivisions in California nowadays because the developers have to calculate the additional vehicle miles traveled by the sprawling suburb and assess a penalty on every single house that has to be paid by the developer and hence by the home buyers in order to mitigate for the vehicle miles traveled. So they're estimating that the high-speed rail will take will reduce vehicle miles traveled in California by 182 million miles a year.
Wow.
That sounds like a lot. The actual, you know, according to the Federal Highway Administration, the actual vehicle miles traveled in California in recent years is in around 340 billion miles per year.
So, I'm sorry, 180 million
180
reduced.
Million compared to 340 billion. So, you're taking 180 million off of 340 billion by building the bullet train. So, you know, this is where it's fun to work with spreadsheets, because that's 1/20th of 1%. You're going to be spending $130 billion, and we know it's going to be more than that, to reduce vehicle miles traveled, which is the big boogeyman, is vehicle miles traveled by 1/20th of 1%. So why don't we just, for the sake of argument, say, well, 1% reduction would be significant. It's not, but let's say it would be. How much would it cost to reduce vehicle miles traveled with high-speed rail by 1%? And that's an easy calculation. It would be $242 trillion.
To get to 1%.
To reduce vehicle miles traveled by 1%. That's the cost effectiveness of climate change mitigation with high-speed rail. And that's preposterous. That, in other words, if you really believe that vehicle miles traveled and CO2 emissions are, you know, this so-called existential threat, why on earth would you be reducing vehicle miles traveled by 1% at a cost of $240 trillion. You know, that, what is that? That's 10 times our entire national GDP. It's something in that ballpark. I mean, it's crazy.
Your background is actually in business finance, and so I'm going to ask you a business question. Part of the pitch to us as taxpayers, as voters back in the early 2000s, was that this thing would be supported largely by passenger fees, right? That you'd buy a ticket.
Yeah.
The ticket would help remunerate the state of California for its construction and maintenance of this project. But if you get to 1%, you're talking about a project of $242 trillion. I can't imagine the interest payments on that amount. But is there any real, sincere, serious estimate out there that you could support this thing through tickets?
You know, it's not hard to look at those numbers, because they do have ridership estimates. And if, let's say it gets built for $130 billion, and let's say they get, I think it's 6 million riders. I forget, you know, I'm sorry. Well, I don't remember exactly what their ridership projections are, but I do know that I did the division just to see what that would come out to per ticket. And it was about $250 a ticket. You know, the way it's structured, and this is another reason why you really have to go back to what how people thought about infrastructure in the 1930s, the 1950s, the 1960s, because those projects paid dividends. What you've got with high-speed rail is not only something that's going to be a permanent drain in terms of what it costs to build and all the payments on all of those bonds that are going to be undermining our ability to make payments for other things for decades afterwards, but operating the train is going to also be a permanent drain on the economy. And that's not necessary. You know, you don't have to build. Why would you build infrastructure that's going to be a permanent drain on the economy that doesn't even pay its own operating costs? I mean, if you're going to do something like that, at least do something that's more useful for more people.
Let's, if you don't mind, let's move on. I want to talk about something that you've written quite a bit about, but I admit that the numbers have scared me off. What is carbon sequestration? I mean, I roughly understand it's a process of burying carbon, but I don't even know what that actually means. A little bit like, how does electricity work? Well, I flip the switch on. So tell us what carbon sequestration is and why state officials are really entranced by the possibilities there.
Well, I will. First of all, they're not entranced by it, but if they're serious about reducing CO2, they should be more entranced by it. They're highly ambivalent about it because they feel that if you sequester carbon from, for example, natural gas power plants, then you're still going to be using natural gas. And if you're still using natural gas, that's a situation where you haven't gotten rid of fossil fuels. So they're very ambivalent about the idea. They don't want a solution like that, even though North America is literally floating on top of natural gas. We have enough natural gas on this continent to power our economy for centuries. So let's start right there. But what you've got potentially with carbon sequestration, and this is using costs from the Department of Energy, and it's using information that we already know about the geology in California. And I was surprised to learn this. There's plenty of capacity. You could pump all of the CO2 that natural gas power plants generate in California underground for several centuries before you'd start looking for new formations to put the stuff. And I didn't realize that. And that's an important variable to, you know, to evaluate and verify. So there's no problem in terms of finding places to put this CO2. That's not an issue. So what does it cost and what are you going to get for it? Because in all of these projects, you have to ask yourself, what is the cost and what is the benefit in this case in terms of gigawatts, right? So California's natural gas power plants generate about one-third currently of the energy we consume, of the electricity we consume. One-third comes from natural gas power plants. One-third comes from everything else, including wind and solar and hydroelectric and nuclear. And one-third we import from other states. Our natural gas power plants, though, only operated about 28%, that's the exact number in 2022 from the California Department of Energy. They're always being turned off whenever the sun shines, whenever the wind blows. They turn them off.
This is a policy decision to just shut them off
because they want to minimize their pollution. So they're not allowed to run as baseload power plants. There's about 40 natural gas power plants left in California. And what they're doing is they're peaker plants. They turn them on when there's high demand in the late afternoon. They turn them off when there's no wind and no sun, you know, at night. And so they only get to run 28% of the time. If they could run all the time, instead of producing one-third of California's current energy consumption, they could produce all of it and then some. So they could take us a very long ways towards becoming a more electric economy. And the cost to retrofit these plants, based on Department of Energy numbers, is only about $45 billion. And I say only because let's think about this compared to the offshore wind. Offshore wind is going to buy us, if we build the whole, you know, build out the whole plan, it's going to buy us 10 gigawatts. Whereas if we have all of these natural gas power plants operating at full efficiency, it would bring us about 40 gigawatts. So you're looking at capacity that is four times as much for about one quarter as much money. I mean, it's more than 10 times more cost effective. So why aren't they at least looking at this more seriously?
Your policy recommendation for us then is, rather than going for wind, rather than looking at solar, hydroelectric, or almost anything else, you're saying we could really safely go back to the future and run our natural gas-powered generators and achieve not only the produce not only the capacity we need, the volume of energy we need in California, but probably have some left over for export, which would be amazing in itself to think about. And then carbon sequestration could fit in there. It sounds like you're kind of ambivalent yourself about whether that's even important, or, you know, that would produce any measurable benefit to the global environment.
Well, you know, you want to ask yourself, if you're in California, what's going to be palatable to the climate lobby? And, you know, so those of us who are skeptical about how dangerous CO2 really is, may look at carbon sequestration and go, oh, come on, you know, that's another complete waste of money. But what's very interesting about carbon sequestration is it does satisfy them, just like nuclear power does. It satisfies the concerns of the climate lobby, but it does so at a cost that is a remote fraction of any other, you know, so-called climate palatable solution. And so if you're going to do something, if you're going to have some big project that you want to spend tens of billions of dollars on, and you're actually serious about mitigating climate change by eliminating CO2 emissions in California, that should be the first thing you're looking at, not the last thing you're looking at.
So just one last question on this. If I'm working at a natural gas electricity generating plant, whatever we call these things, am I capturing the, I don't know what you call it, the emissions from this plant in like a tube, and then propelling that down into the Earth's crust or something? Is that how this works?
Correct.
And then what happens to it down there?
They call it flue gas. And what you have to do is you have to divert it into a compressor, and you have to condense it, and that helps you extract the CO2. And then you literally pump it down into geologic formations, cavities under the earth that are 5,000 to 10,000 feet down. And again, they've looked at the costs to do this, and they've done an assessment of where these formations are in the state of California, and there's plenty of them. And the cost, or I should say the energy cost to do this varies, you know, according to how far down you're pumping it. But the concentration of CO2 in flue gas is about 4%. I mean, compare that to carbon sequestration out of the atmosphere. They're spending billions of dollars to try to take CO2 out of the atmosphere, which is 0.04%, you know, compared to 4%. So it's, you know, it's 100 times more concentrated in the flue gas, which means that it's 100 times more practical and cost-effective to take it out of the flue gas of these natural gas power plants. The estimate is it would cost about 12% of the energy. In other words, you would lose, if a natural gas power plant's producing 100 megawatts, you would actually only be producing 88 megawatts, because you'd need the other 12 megawatts to perform the capture, condensing, and pumping underground. So that is an energy penalty that you would pay.
So what happens to the carbon that's pumped down into the earth? What does it do down there?
It just sits there and gets absorbed eventually. It's so far down that it's apparently not a threat any longer. There are some theories that it actually eventually becomes part of the rock down there. I haven't looked into that seriously enough yet, Will, to tell you exactly what happens to it down there, other than to verify that there's plenty of room.
The 5-year-old in me tells me that the earth is like a balloon, and at some point it either just starts like putt-putting around the room as we let a balloon go. We haven't, you know, you don't have this in your notes, but I wonder if you'll just spare me a moment and talk about California's last remaining nuclear power plant at Diablo, which was supposed to be shut down. Gavin Newsom, I think, in a panic, realized, holy cow, I shut this thing down. We have no excess capacity. If, you know, if the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing and the natural gas plants have all been shut down by the maniacs, I've got a nuclear power plant at Diablo Canyon. Are you still, or were you ever? What's your perspective on nuclear, and where should California be thinking about nuclear in this all of the above plan?
Yeah, well, nuclear is safer than it's ever been. We make more progress, you know, every decade with nuclear power. It would be crazy to shut Diablo Canyon down. When Diablo Canyon was first designed, it was going to have 6 reactors, and they only built 2 of them. But those still contribute, you know, a gigawatt each. You're getting 2 gigawatts of power.
And remind me, how much of that, what percentage of our total energy need every day is 2%?
Yeah. Well, you know, the average consumption is about 32 gigawatts. The peak usually goes over about 50 gigawatts. That's like in the summer when everybody's air conditioners are running in the late afternoon. You'll be drawing about 50 gigawatts off the grid. At night, it troughs down to 20 or maybe a little under 20 gigawatts. So what you've got from Diablo Canyon is 2 gigawatts that's just always running. You know, the uptime is well into the 90%. Mm-hmm. So that's very reliable power. And there's a lot of new technologies with nuclear power that are very interesting. Technologies where they reuse the waste over and over again as fuel until the waste is down to a dangerous half-life of only a few years. So we should be looking at, California is supposed to be the state of innovation. We should be doing innovation that people in the rest of the world want to emulate, not stuff that people in the rest of the world look at and laugh at us and say, we're not about to do that. People in China and India and Indonesia, you know, nations with hundreds of millions of people living there, they're not going to do this. They want to industrialize. They want a higher standard of living. They're going to build nuclear power plants, and they're going to build natural gas power plants and even coal power plants. And if you can offer them ways to mitigate the emissions from those plants, if that's your big concern, they're going to listen. But if you tell them you can't have any of this, you have to build wind farms and solar farms and batteries, they're not going to listen. So we're not setting an example if that's our goal. Because, you know, everybody's heard the story. It's only 1% of the emissions in the world come from California, so it doesn't matter. But it does matter if you're trying to set an example. But we're not setting an example that anybody is interested in.
That's a, I was going to say, wonderful, but perhaps dire place to end. I think that's exactly right. That's my colleague, Edward Ring, one of the founders of California Policy Center, senior fellow, writes for us primarily about energy and water, but also public finance, when I can urge him to do that as well. You can find his work on our website. Ed, you've also got the separate website for the Water and Energy Project. You want to tell us what those are? And I'll put those in the show notes, too.
Yeah, that's abundancecalifornia.com. And what you can find there under news is a collection of newsletters we put out every week where we try to present the numbers. We try to present relevant numbers, back of the envelope type analysis of what the cost and benefit trade-offs are for energy and water solutions in California.
Now, you actually do speak around the state too. Anything upcoming that listeners should know about?
A lot of stuff has been oriented to water lately. I hope we can talk about water next time, Will.
Yeah.
The desalination conference, there was a water and energy summit down in Kern County. We're working on something in Kern County that's going to be more oriented to energy, but also how energy policies affect all of the other industries in Kern County and also in California. So those kind of opportunities, I think, are really helpful just to bring members of industry together and identify common areas to work on policy changes so that California can be affordable again.
One of the reasons I love talking to you, Ed, even if it's too infrequently, is that, you know, on the show, we spend an awful lot of time talking about first principles around headline news, but you're really doing the kind of lifting up your head from the desk and looking over the distant horizon, I think, to see what's next. And I really love your imagination, your willingness to wrestle with big numbers and difficult concepts. So thanks for making that easy for us, and we'll get you again on here next time. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you. Anytime, Will.
Well, that's all we have today. Thanks for spending your time with us. You can always find Radio Free California podcast on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and better for us if you subscribe. And of course, rate and review the show wherever you do subscribe. That boosts our profile, and that helps others find and join this band of brothers and sisters. Email us your comments and your hopeful story suggestions about California. Let's make that a kind of an item here. Let's look for reasons for optimism. I actually think the Google story today was a reason for optimism, no? And watching progressives who are perhaps shocked by anti-Semitism. These are good stories. There are others. You'll find our email addresses and other fun details in the show notes, and you can follow us on Twitter at the Radio Free CA. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to session producers Lucas Klaus, Brian Tong, and Glenn Hall, and to National Review podcast producer Sarah Schutte. Thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based mariachi and metal band, for our music. La Revolución continúa en la semana próxima.